When did you start to get interested in video as a medium?
Yeah. Well, my first interest was while I was doing fine arts degree at Newcastle upon Tyne Polytechnic in the studio of Stuart Marshall, who was newly back from America, having studied new music with Alvin Lucier, amongst others, and was widening out the whole scene of the art department into sound, video, film and photography were there already, really. So I first got my hands on an Akai quarter-inch reel-to-reel quarter pack in that studio, and the piece that I came up with, once I realised you could record for up to an hour without costing an arm and a leg as film would, so I made a piece of work that was called Changing, and it was all my clothing, every item of clothing I owned, hung on a rack, as in a shop, and I just simply recorded from a static point of view, set the recorder going, and then changed through all the clothes that I own, randomly changing things, so that I ended up with weird combinations of clothing on until I'd worn everything at least once, and I ended up naked with a large pile of used clothing on the floor in front of me. And that was the end of the video. And it never really went any further than that, except it was just the knowledge that, you could make a lengthy piece of work, record it, and keep it.
Did it come out of a performance that you'd done, a similar performance?
Well, at that time, I thought of myself as a performance artist, really, and I made pieces of work about eating. I ate a 12-course meal in front of an audience until I threw up. Drinking. I drank a whole bottle of whiskey and smoked a packet of cigarettes, lighting one off the end of the other all the way through until I threw up again. You know, so it was this kind of pushing the limits, but also applying it to very basic things, you know, eating, drinking, clothing, all, you know, the basic stuff that we do all the time. But again, just trying to stretch limits.
So the difference between, say, doing something like this live as opposed to doing it to camera. Did it appeal to you that you didn't have to appear, that you had this surrogate self that you could present to an audience? Was that relevant? Well, I mean, why record it is what I'm thinking.
Right. I think, to me at that time, it was not that relevant. I actually preferred to do live work and you know, have an installation that I took part in and people came to watch or experience. And, you know, I was more interested in that experience of something occurring over time in a place, all those elements. I did one, I'm trying to remember the title I gave it now. But anyway, I realised again that it's trying to break everything down to its most basic elements. So to have a performance, you need a place, a time, a duration, a person or a performer, and an audience. There you go. That's it. That's all you need. And so I set that up, a place, a time, advertised it, and I just walked on stage. Stood there for a few minutes till people started mumbling and whatever, and then I walked off. So in a sense, I'd done all the bare bones of what constitutes a performance. Mm. So, it, I messed about in those kind of ways.
So then you switched from this kind of live, yourself in front of an audience in a particular situation, to recording things, right?
Yeah.
So why that, where did it, what was the driving force that took you, say, out of the live and into the recorded?
The piece of work that I made, far more so than the changing piece, was a piece I made for the video show at the Serpentine Gallery, which was called Yet Another Triangle.
Mm.
So it was this idea of triangular relationship that was unstable. And at that point, the recording process and the performing process and the exhibiting process all kind of came together in one piece of work. So you couldn't have made the piece of work without the recording, three quarter pack recording process, three people in a space moving around. I don't know whether you recorded this earlier, but the idea was that the instruction was that to each of the performers was to keep the other two performers in shot. And that was impossible for everybody to achieve. So there was a constant movement and jockeying for space. Did you record it earlier?
I think it's important that we're getting this, because I think I didn't realize it hadn't started recording until we got to the, I think, about technical facilities. So it's quite good to have this. I think that transition from a live situation to one where you started to think about, okay, what happens when I can record something? What does that add? Where does that take me? And you started to think about the situation of the recording itself, of the of the relationship between the camera and the participant or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's really quite important, isn't it, I think? And that's what appealed to you, was that you could add this other layer I don't know what you want to call it, to the experience for the audience.
Yeah,
you were adding a whole other layer, which was to do with the relationship between the camera and the apparatus and and the situation.
And then the screening of that was equally put the audience in the same predicament as the camera. The people with the cameras, the monitors were on the points of an equilateral triangle facing inwards, and you had to stand in between it all to experience the piece. But you could only see any two at any one time.
Right.
So you as a viewer had to choose, make a choice of where you were going to look, and the sound created a three-dimensional environment in which to experience what the people making it had done. In fact, David Hall said a nice thing in watching the piece. He said it's the most it's like the experience of being behind the camera. To be there watching the piece.
Yeah.
So it kind of really came through. What was going on?
What's occurring to me, because I haven't seen this piece, but I mean, from your description, I get a sense that there's a real jump between, say, the clothing piece and the three camera piece, because you started, you realized what you could do with the medium that you couldn't do with a live situation. Guess you could have had it. No, I don't think you could. I mean, it's actually very...
No, it wouldn't work live at that time, no.
Yeah. So it's very quick, that jump. And it's very relevant to this thing about... You've described it, I think it's very good. So now we have that. And we know that you trained with Stuart, which is... Were there other people besides Stuart that were... I mean, David, obviously. But he came in as almost as a colleague, interestingly enough.
Didn't he? David Hall.
Yeah.
We didn't meet until the Serpentine video show.
Okay, when that was a couple of 75.
May 75.
Right.
So at that point, Steve Partridge, Roger Barnard, Tamara Kerkorian, Tony Sinden, all the Maidstone gang, David Hall, of course, met Stuart, myself, Johnny Turpey, Pete Livingstone, people from Newcastle. Mm. And, you know, it was really the genesis of starting to talk about the idea of something that became London Video Arts, right. Basically.
Okay. Yeah.
But there were other people around in the college in Newcastle, Keith Frake and Johnny Turpey, amongst others. Fast forward, Pete Livingstone was there. And you know, we were all involved in this area of media of whatever kind, you know.
Mm. Okay, no, that's great. I think that covers that first thing very nicely, and I'm sorry I missed it first time around, but I think you actually added to it, so that's quite good. And I think we've got the thing about access, but let's just do it again, which is it was through the art school, wasn't it? And you said what equipment was available. It was this quarter-inch and porter pack, basically, was what it, and it was the college that owned it. I mean, I think we probably have it now. I think, you know, we can probably let you off the hook. It'd been several hours. You probably had enough of this.
Okay.
Yeah, but go on.
I did write a kind of summary where they say open questions at the end.
Good. Yeah.
I don't know. Is it worth me blathering?
Yes. Got yes. Time for that, yeah. Quick? Yes. Of course. Yes.
Okay. It's just a paragraph.
Yeah. Go like for that. It. Yeah.
So, as an open question, this is with hindsight, really, looking back at all the stuff we've been talking about, I felt that video art, in inverted commas, was a specific approach that only lasted for a finite window of time.
Yeah.
Specifically about 1970 to the early 1980s. Before that, there were no accessible video facilities. There was television, but we couldn't access it on the whole. Mm. After that, everyone had access. After the early 80s, everyone had access. Home video recorders, camcorders, etc. And it was the whole thing just blew open. So it was just that specific period of time where it was this who could get their hands on porter packs, basically, were the people who could make video art. And so the nature of the content changed at that point. People could make videos about anything. No longer medium specific, but neither subject specific, and therefore could be applied to anything. I saw my own last major piece of work, pieces I never did, as an expansive and ironic summary of many strands of my own and others' work from the 1970s. It was made in 1979, and after that, I only used video as a tool to address content other than video itself being the subject. So that's about it as some kind of summary anyway.
I think that's really useful because I think it does encapsulate what you've been talking about in more, you know, you've been talking about in more detail, but that kind of gives us a nice overview. You can almost use that as an introductory paragraph.
You did what you could. You got your hands on it through art centres or colleges at that time, yeah.
The piece you described, the another triangle piece, was it on three screens when it was presented at the Serpentine? Or did you edit it?
Well, the presentation of the piece was mirrored, the making of it. So I put it on three screens, each on the apex of an equilateral triangle. So as a viewer, you had the same problem as the people making the recording, that you could not see all three at the same time. You could only ever see two. So the piece was inherently unstable, as it were. It made, you know, both in the shooting of it and in the viewing of it.
Right. So it was an installation, really. I mean, it's a multiple or a multi-screen video. I don't know what the difference is, but
it was a three-screen spatial.
Hmm.
It was a spatial arrangement of screens in a gallery space.
Yeah.
And of course, the sound was very important because the sound moved around the space.
Right.
And if people actually crashed into each other, you know, that was some way you would look. And you know, the sound space moved around.
Mm. I'm just thinking that we've jumped from a single screen thing to a multi-screen thing in a moment. Yeah. And just going back to this thing about video and what it could and couldn't do and what you discovered, presumably one of the things you discovered almost by default was that there was this multi-screen format, which was completely different to television. And a lot more to do with the spatial, architectural spatial problems or issues than, say, some of the performance things you might have done were. Because you're immediately playing on the electronic space versus the visual space, or the acoustic space versus the physical space. Yeah.
But certainly the acoustic space was important into replaying. But I mean, even after that, when I made single screen pieces, or you would watch them single screen, they were often made through multiple screens.
Right.
And again, had a sound space that followed the sort of passing backwards and forwards of different parts of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I have got these things on screen here, but I don't think that necessarily helps us, does it?
It's going to be tricky from that point of view. I think what we can do is we can refer to some of these works, and then if and when they come to say, well, what about how maybe we'll show some of this stuff at the ZKM exhibition, then we can get back to you and say, how about this piece or that piece? I think that's the way. So what we'll do is we'll refer to them in our discussion, as you have.
Yeah.
So, in fact, let me also say, I think I might have missed the recording of that first set of questions, so we might go back to those at the end. Yeah, just again, you know, starting with Newcastle and so on. But don't worry about it now. I'm just thinking about, there's a very nice question here about, did the access to technical material affect your practice in any way? Because I think that's an intriguing one. You know, I know you had to adapt all the time, but do you think that's what it boiled down to? Did, in other words, you know, what you could get your hands on, did that affect the kind of work you made?
Yeah, definitely. I think I've got a scribble here. I said that, it was specifically about the nature and capabilities of the video technology.
Mm.
Did
that come out of... David, did that come out of, you know, what was going on in film at the time, do you think, avant-garde film, or do you think it came out of the fact that you were messing with this technology and it brought up certain... challenges, shall we say?
Yeah, I made film pieces at this same time. You know, I went first to London. I showed at the Filmmakers Co-op and carried on making short film pieces. Even got an Arts Council grant to finish a film off. I work with film, but I saw video as a different. I did see it as a different thing with different possibilities, not just the image thing. And in fact, the thing that annoyed me at the time, probably still does, is that the filmmaking fraternity would always criticize video for its low resolution, black and white as it was at the time. And the fact that you could record for an hour was irrelevant to them. They were about this kind of beautiful film image thing. And in a sense, the video was about something else. It was about structuring time and space, whether or not you were working with multiple cameras and screens or singly. So it was different. I saw it as
I just wondered how much influence there was from kind of what was at the time a very dominant aesthetic in avant-garde film in the 70s. I can remember, you know, because I sort of fell into the scene from outside in a sense. And the thing that struck me right away is how powerful, you know, that co-op structural materialist sort of aesthetic was, and how dominant it was. I mean, not just in film, but in photography, you know, amongst artists working with the medium. It's funny because there's a sense in which it seemed to me that video was coming from somewhere else, even though it looked at the time as if it were how we're picking up some of the same issues, but actually it wasn't. And you know, some of the things you're touching on there with this business about the screen and the space and the acoustic relationships to the recording space and all of that were not things that the filmmakers were really interested in. I also remember how divided everything was. And if you went to the co-op, they kind of looked at you askance. I remember turning up at some screening in David Curtis was at the door. It was a film screen. Yeah. It was what's his name? P. Adam Sitney giving a talk, right? You remember him? He's the guy that coined the structural film thing. And I came to the door and I gave my ticket and it was Dave. And he said, what are you doing here? You're a video maker. And I said, David, I'm interested in film as well. He's like, you weren't allowed to be, interested or anything.
I'm sure he said it slightly tongue-in-cheek, but I hope.
Not sure he did, but yeah.
you're touching on a good one here because, you know, as I say, when I moved to London, I was still shooting film and making film, finishing film, 16mm with sound, needed money, and I got a little Arts Council grant. So I had engaged with Dave Curtis, who was the film officer, artist film, not officer anyway, and the co-op as a filmmaker. So I think I was, it helped me actually in the longer term,
maybe,
because it meant I was already a known quantity, and then getting involved in video was a move. But I already knew all those guys and they knew me, so that helped.
That's interesting. I don't think I was aware of that because I saw you as a video person. I put you in that box.
Yeah.
Not just you, but a number of people. I guess Stuart Marshall, because I met Stuart through Alex and through David Hall. Because David and Stuart lived next door to each other on Brading Road. Do you remember in Brixton?
I know.
So I remember that. But of course, I didn't know about the connection with experimental music that Stuart Marshall was bringing to bear on it. I wasn't aware of that. I didn't know about that tradition. Anyway, I digress. I mean, let's just jump back in here. There's this thing about the relationship to broadcast TV, which you've touched on. But I mean, there's a stupid question, which we won't even bother with. What looked like the TV broadcast in your own country? I mean, I think... in each of the European countries that we're, you know, kind of involved with, I think broadcast TV was different. There were quite distinctive differences between one country and another in terms of television. So, you know, I think things like that, it's a big, long one. But I think the question that I put in, I think, is do you consider your work to be in some way oppositional to mainstream television, which you've said... In a sense, yes. Did you like the idea that it might get broadcast on television, or did you not want that or see that as relevant?
At that time, I didn't want that. And in fact, I specifically, I mean, just if I can just unpack that one a little bit.
Yeah, please.
I've just said here that in answer to that strange question, I've said that TV was very hierarchical in Britain. Mm. Unionized, restricted for most people. And when, again, I'm just going to widen it out a bit, the Serpentine Time Video Show, which I had that piece in, and which we traveled to along with Stuart Marshall, Pete Livingstone, possibly Johnny Turpie as well. And we met David Halls, Pete Partridge, Tony Sinden. And that group actually was, as far as I'm concerned, and that meeting was the genesis of London Video Arts, because we actually sat down and had conversation. I remember having the conversation with Steve Partridge about, well, what do we do when we've all finished college in 3 months' time? And how are we going to get our hands on equipment then? You know, and we started to talk about forming an organisation there and then. And bit by bit, you know, that was 1975. A bit by 1976, we were putting it all together and applying for money and getting the catalogue off the ground. And David Hall writing articles in Studio International.
Yep.
I managed to make the cover.
Yeah, there you are.
There I am.
Yeah. You look just the same, Dave.
Yeah, just the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of blurred. So all of that, coming back to the broadcast TV, I think David Hall had a relationship with broadcast TV. Often his work was kind of about broadcast TV. But in my case, I was in my own mind, separate from that. I was not interested in broadcast TV. And I saw the London Video Arts exhibition programme and distribution as an alternative, really, to television, and sitting in a gallery with an audience watching some work and then talking about it seemed to me to be a better way to spend your time than sitting around watching TV.
Because it was less passive. There was an active engagement in some sense. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right about David, because when I reflected back and when I did that interview with David for the book, he was very clear that what he was looking for was a different audience. He wasn't interested in the art audience, because he felt that they were the same people all the time. And he felt that he could reach a completely different set of people.
Yeah.
I think that's quite probably amongst British video arts quite unusual, video artists.
Well, it is when you analyse it, through that historical lens. And I suppose also it makes me think, you know, David Hall was already an established sculptor in the 60s, even, and then a filmmaker, really. I mean, his 7 TV pieces or whatever they're called,
the film,
however many there were, they were shot on film, and then broadcast on television. So, he did have a different approach to it. And again, I would say, you know, God bless him, he's not with us anymore, but, you know, his at the Serpentine show, he did a piece called 101 Television Sets.
With
so
Tony,
100 TVs and one video channel. And then he made that fantastic, I think, piece of work at Ambika P3, 1,001 Television Sets, to coincide with the end of analog broadcast. Again, beautifully conceived and executed. And timed piece of work.
It's a different strand, but he was so dominant that I think, I mean, I, you know, I was under the aegis, I guess, of Peter Donibauer at the time, and they had a big argument about what video was about and so on. And it's ironic that in fact Peter ended up being a broadcast person, running Diverse and all the rest of it. Anyway, let's keep with this thing. I think, this business about, there's a question now about how your work with video evolved, because obviously your work did develop from those very first performance-oriented pieces quite quickly to something that was about the video medium itself, away from performance. Is that right or not fair?
Yes, it did. And if you like, in the way, I think, if, talking about my own work, but that's what we're doing. The first pieces were kind of performance pieces. Then there was a period when I made half a dozen very specifically video technologically oriented sort of pieces of work. Mm. And that was when I had started at the Royal College of Art and had access again to a studio and a moderate amount of reel-to-reel black and white equipment. And in collaboration with Brian Young, who taught on that course, who also taught in Chelsea fine art, they also had a load of equipment. So there's one piece I made called Memory 1 and 2, I think it's called, and I needed four monitors to stack and replay what I was doing and saying. And we had to put together the equipment from Chelsea and the RCA in order to get that going. So, you know, I made use of the fact I was in a college that had some gear, but then they our department, Environmental Media, bought some pneumatic equipment, a pneumatic porta pack and camera, and everything changed again. And I realized it was sufficiently good quality and in color, and I could edit it accurately at Fantasy Factory, by the way, because the college didn't have the edit decks. But it meant I could go back, if you like. So Pieces I Never Did is essentially a collection of performance or structural film stroke video pieces, all edited together, put together in a way that you couldn't have done possibly with black and white reel-to-reel equipment. And really, I felt, in a sense, I'm jumping to the end here.
No, that's but okay. I felt that, go whichever way.
For me, that was the end. It was like I felt when I did a three screen edited down, everyone edited in sync down to the last second. Everything had changed. This was no longer, you know, video art in the sense of struggling with the medium and its possibilities, but rather this was you know, and especially over the next few years, you'd be in an edit suite with the mixing desks and sound mixing and vision mixing, etc. And then the whole nature of it changed because it became about the content, about the subject, about, you know,
right,
what you were making these pieces or programs about.
Yeah,
I felt.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because, first of all, I just want to say the little window popped up to tell me that I had 10 minutes left. What we'll do is when it dies, I'll just call you up again. Yeah. But,
yeah.
I mean, you've just done this thing here where it says, have you stopped working with video? And if so, what year and why? And you've kind of covered that, but it's interesting. Is that why? I mean, is that why you stopped, in a sense? Or did you stop?
I did, really. Yeah. I made Pieces I Never Did in 1979, and I exhibited it quite widely over a couple of years. And I made some small pieces as I was going along for the next 2 years.
Mm.
And then I really did stop. And it was partly to do with the fact that I felt that the nature of the scene had changed, but also I changed. I became a Christian, and I got interested in, I mean, eventually I started a production company with another guy.
I remember.
We made videos for the church, for the sort of documentary pieces for the Methodist Church and the Baptists and you name it, for 3 or 4 years.
Mm.
Yeah.
So there was a sense in which you felt that the medium had moved on to such an extent that the one of the driving forces for you as an artist had disappeared, or at least had submerged in a way, and it was no longer as interesting to you because of the way the technology had developed and its accessibility and so on. Was that fair?
I think it wasn't all to do with the technology. It was partly the technology.
Yeah.
It was, as I said, the once you've got pneumatic recording and editing, then people could apply that to any number of subjects. And what really changed to me was, if you think of LVA, London Video Arts, as an organisation, which I worked at from, 1982 to 86, you know, that was my job. And the whole nature of the organisation changed. The people who were involved in it changed, their subject matter changed. And I felt, you know, as I say, I personally had changed, we parted ways. But it was not just about technology anymore at that point, because the technology was good enough that people could apply it to many different topics.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting, because I hadn't thought about it quite like that. Let's just plow on. And I've just spotted this one. Do you consider yourself as a video artist?
Well, I did.
Yeah.
I did for a period. Yeah.
And has the tool of video changed your thinking about artistic practices? But back in the past, I guess that's where we're looking at, isn't it? At a certain point. Do you think that's true, that video itself changed the way you thought about what art was?
I think yes. It changed what you could make art about, certainly. Mm. I mean, the first Bill Viola piece I saw was in Maastricht, where we went to an exhibition, took part in a video manifestation, it was called. Stuart Marshall, David Hall, Steve Partridge, the whole gang went to Maastricht, and we saw for the first time Bill Viola's piece where he drops a symbol in a crowd, a flock, do you call it, of pigeons, and then they all take off, and it's in ultra slow motion, so incredibly high res and beautifully shot and great movement. And again, it was like sort of taking a look at possibilities that then continue to develop, especially by some people, Bill Viola, obviously, and others. There was a piece by Ira Schneider I saw a little bit later in the States, the Whitney, I think it was, which was called Time Zones, and it was kind of an hour's recording in each of the 24 time zones around the world, and then played back in a circular arrangement of 24 monitors. So you had a kind of overview of a day in the space of an hour around the whole world. So again, just the fact that you could apply the technology in that kind of way, if you wanted to, you know, those kind of possibilities became something that we could all do if we put our mind to it, you know.
And did the experience of seeing that work or those kinds of works impact on your practice, do you think? Did you go back and pick up the camera or whatever, pick up the kit and think of it in a different way as a result of that?
No, I didn't. I just saw it again as part of this kind of movement, away from what I had been doing. And actually, my own interests had changed by time. So I was happy to observe it and see it and take part in it in different ways. But I wasn't actively making work in that way then.
Mm. Mm. What date are we talking? Can you remember?
Okay, so that's early 80s. Yeah. Talking, 81, 82, that kind of time.
Okay.
And that's when I would say I made video art from 73 to 82, about 10 years roughly, and was specifically about the nature of the medium from 75 to 79.
Why do you think that was so relevant to your way of looking at the world? That's a bit of a trick question, maybe. I'm throwing it in because I don't see it there. But I'm just thinking about the way that obviously it was quite important that that way of thinking and that way of working, and it suited something about the way you looked at things or the way you wanted to look at things. I'm just wondering if you can throw any light on that.
I think it was because, yeah, I know what you're saying, and I think it's a mixture of a couple of things. One is the group of people who were involved. So we're, you know, talking David Hall, Stuart Marshall, Steve Partridge, and the TV Butler's Wharf people as well. Martin Hearn made films, Mick Duckworth, and did performance work. Kevin Atherton did video and performance. And I think that, I think of it as a conversation between a group of people who knew each other.
Yeah,
there were more than the ones I've just mentioned, but and who shared that interest and then responded to each other's work actually.
That's really interesting, because I don't think that comes out a lot, that whole, because I think there was this context that you guys had created together and with for each other and you know, obviously looking outwards as well. Okay, I've died it. But we were talking about this group thing, this sort of context, I guess, sort of creative context that was created around, I guess, LVA in a way. So it wasn't just about access, it was about some kind of dialogue. You were responding to each other's work and responding to each other's way of thinking about the work. I think that's really important and doesn't come out with these questions. So that's, I'm happy we've touched on that. I know you've written notes, so you probably, because you know, I'm sometimes ignoring some questions. So if there are things, I'm just thinking if there are points that you had in your notes that were missed because I didn't ask the question, do feel free just to jump in. I've got this thing here about video as a specific medium of one of several tools. So I guess that's. What does it say here? What were your uses of video, experimental artistic tapes, installations, performances? Yeah, I suppose, in what different ways did you use video? And clearly you were doing installation-type things as well, and you were doing performance-to-camera work, weren't you? I mean, would you say that other ways... I mean, you said you started making videos for other organizations and so on. Did you think of any of those as being, in any sense, having an artistic content or context?
At this point in time, I wasn't doing, making programs. I was involved in the art theme through the Royal College of Art, people there, through... LVA, everybody involved in LVA, and 2B Butler's Wharf, everybody involved in that. So, and then also the Acme thing. I mean, we lived in Acme houses. We showed, LVA had a slot in the Acme gallery regularly, evening shows, and individuals did exhibitions at Acme. I showed pieces I never did there in 1979 for a week or so, you know. And so if you start putting all those organisations together, it made me really, thinking about this, realise how social it was, actually. It was a very social scene with people... taking part in all of those areas, Butler's Wharf, Acme, LVA, and so on. I think I did write something in relation to this bit. I said, video appeared to be an emerging medium. It was flexible for time and editing compared to film and performance, and is a unique one-off whilst video is recorded, performance is a unique one-off while video is recorded and can be screened flexibly and transported. So it became very flexible. And so in the late, a little bit in the, towards the end, well, Maastricht in 76, and then later on, I showed in Holland, France, Poland, and then America, and it became a much wider group of connections, you know. And you know, we've been helped. We as a group had been helped by people like David Hall and Stuart Marshall, because they were just older and more well connected as well with the music scene, as well as Alvin Lucier and people like that. And you know, there was a background to it in a social set of connections as well.
Do you think there's something unique about the British scene, as given that you were going and seeing work in other countries, showing your work in other countries, and you know, also having a chance to see what other artists were doing? Do you think there was something that characterized the British work in that period that was particular and specific, or particular, I suppose, unique? I don't know.
I don't, you know, my immediate thought is no, I don't think so, actually. I think it was pretty wide, what would you call it, capture area. People did a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And, you know, the some with music, some with sound, some with performance, some with technology. Some started to stray over into, by the early 80s, into, you know, rock music, pop music, people making pop videos, and so on, and so it spread and spread and spread, I don't think the British thing was, you know, you couldn't just look at anything and say it's British, except perhaps the language. But even then, I mean, I. If I may reiterate this one, I like what happened here, which was from screening in Stuttgart at the Künstlerhaus called Video im Abendland, which I'm not sure exactly what it means, but evening land or something. Okay. Anyway, at that I met Nan Hoover. And I screened pieces I never did. And as it finished with Big Ass Shut Up, the audience actually, they erupted, you know, applause and people standing up. And they said, show it again, now. I said, oh, God, you know, I said, I was very... pleased, obviously. I said, okay, look, I'll show it again, I'll set it up, but I'm going to the bar, you know. So I set it up, set it going, and they all sat down for it again. And Nan Hoover came to the bar with me, and we sat and had a good chat and a drink before we went back. Then, because of meeting in under good circumstances, as we were, Nan introduced me or invited me really to do a show at the Apple in
Amsterdam.
Yeah. V. Smiles and Josine van Droffelaar, and who sadly both perished in an air crash.
Wow.
Extraordinary. Marina Abramovic was a friend of Nan's, and she was tied up the evening I was going to do the screening. So she actually came in the afternoon and had a private screening. And I sat with Marina and watched pieces I never did together in the afternoon, which was very lovely. You know, it was a really nice thing to do. And again, you know, these things just connect you up. And I ended up from the Stuttgart end of the story, meeting a guy, Zdzisław Sosnowski from Poland, who invited me to show a British video in Warsaw. And so I went over there and showed in the big theater studio building built by the Russians to dominate Poland in those days. And This is the one where I arrived with tapes on U-Matic, and they did not have a U-Matic recorder, so I had to describe what we were doing to an audience of like 300 people, including the British ambassador in Poland, from you know what we were doing. And it, anyway, eventually they got from the television station, they got a U-Matic deck, and we were able to show the tapes later and that week. And you know, so it's like it began to have an impetus,
a momentum,
you know, movement, all of its own. You know, you go somewhere, you meet people, you do something, they pass you on to someone else, and so it goes. You know, which is rather. Thinking about it in the context of this questions and so forth, I really realized, wow, you know, we could have done a lot more actually.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. There was an opportunity there, which maybe didn't develop in the way that it might have. I mean, it's always easy with hindsight to think, oh, well, perhaps, but okay. Well, like that's really valuable. What about this thing with the audio? We need to touch on it. How important was the audio track in your work? I mean, I thought it was probably crucial, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Very important. And, you know, even some of the sort of low quality, relatively, you know, reel to reel black and white pieces, that they revolved around the sound, actually. Static acceleration has an increasing beat for the first minute up to as fast as I could go, and then the next 10 minutes it has a static beat or a regular beat, and the video image is then stretched to fit the static beat from its original increasing speed. So really the sound is the structural element that moves, you know, the video was, the image was changed because of it. And then I made pieces that like Trialogue, where I split a text into three collections of words. But again, spoke them back, one screen, one monitor, one generation, as it were, at a time, and then put them back together to make a complete sentence. So again, it was the sound side that
drove the whole. I mean, did you explore the potential of sound or the relationship of image to sound? Yeah, you clearly did.
Absolutely,
that's quite important. I'm going over the page. How would you define your work at the time? I don't even know what that question means. I suppose it means whether it's art or not. Do you think it is?
Where's that question?
Next page. Chris? Next page. Flip the page to the next page.
Oh, right. Okay. No, mine's compressed. It's just still here.
So the status.
How would you define your work at the time?
Yeah. And how?
Again, it comes back to something we mentioned a few minutes ago. But I said as part of an artistic conversation between artists I knew and those from a wider group, including nationally and internationally.
I think that's good. Yeah. How did you choose your titles, David? I mean...
What I've said is they're either literally descriptive or poetically descriptive.
Right.
Sometimes with a humorous or ironic element as well. So my titles are, I would say they're all to some extent descriptive, but I try and work in there a bit of humor or irony, as it were.
So there was sometimes double meanings. Okay, now how about this one? You've touched on this a lot, but how Have other artists influenced your switch to this technology?
Yeah.
And more directly, your practice. Now, I guess what they mean is have our other artists influence your practice, and have our other artists influence you picking up the video camera, if you like, for want of a better way of describing it. I mean, do you think Stuart was instrumental?
Oh, yeah, I've mentioned him straight away. Yeah, I said, Stuart Marshall in 1973 and for a number of years afterwards. And then generally I've said performance artists and some using video. So it could be Kevin Atherton or many other, actually. Where are we saying switch to that technology? Yeah, I mean, it was taking part with a group of people, basically. Yeah,
right. So there was a context that was created out of a focus on what you could do with video, but also what you couldn't do with it.
Yeah,
because it was about the limitations as well, because I've always thought that limitations are more interesting than open possibilities, you know, that it's a lot more interesting to push up against the edge of something than it is to find yourself in a wide open space where you could go in any direction.
Absolutely. I made a piece called Instruction Limitation, which I just watched again, and I can't believe how boring it is, but at the same time, that's exactly what it's about. It's an image of me on screen instructing myself to do all the things that you could do with a reel-to-reel Sony edit deck, you know, slowing it down, speeding it up, stopping it, starting it, whatever. Mm. And that's literally what it is. It's working out all the different things that did, and then finding a way to do them.
Right.
Literally, but in the end, it ends up being, I think, it's so literal that it kind of loses it for me now. I mean, it's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny now.
Yeah. Well, that's a point. Yes. What about other sources? You know, other than, let's say, people who are working with the same medium as you, were there other sources that really influenced your practice? I mean, obviously, you've said performance.
Right.
What about, do you think that the filmmakers were influential on how you work with video, for example? Or any, you know, books, poetry,
music? Well, I think books were... books about video art were few and far between then, and unlike this stack of a dozen books I've got next to me now, that including by yourself, you know, we've got plenty, and also, you know, there were articles in magazines like Studio and Art and Artists. So I would say the Art Press and Studio International, Art and Artists Art Forum, and then the organisations like Toby Butler's Wharf, the Filmmakers Co-op, Acme Gallery and others, you know. So and of course, you know, we're all aware of what was going on socially and politically around us as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that, I mean, we don't have to, I mean, did you work with other artists, performers, visual artists, collectively? I mean, you've talked about the collective way that you were reacting and responding to each other's work, so that's slightly different, but I suppose that's really what that question's about, because it's, the heading is collective, so I think you've covered that very well.
No, I think we definitely collaborated in terms of exhibitions, exhibition space, studio space.
But helping each other out? Helping each other out with production and stuff?
Yeah. I think that's what I was going to come to. Yeah, but I think there was a lot of helping each other out going on. And again, with hindsight, we tended to not really credit each other too much either. You know, pieces I never did involved probably a dozen other people, you know, some of whom appear on screen, and yet it was never kind of part of it in that sense. We were all still in that mode of operating as individual artists, you would help people out to achieve their aims, and you'd leave it at that, you know.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's true.
Yeah.
How about this? In your country, do you belong to the first or second wave of video artists? I think I know the answer.
Well, they're putting you on the spot there. I mean, I'd venture that I was probably amongst the first, to be honest.
I would say so. Yeah.
1973 was about as far back as you'll find work. I think Clive Richardson made some similar visual performance pieces in 72. Because he was at Chelsea and they had a porter pack. I mean, it was literally who could get their hands on porter packs. And before 72 and 3, they just weren't around.
No, I certainly would see you as first generation. How did information circulate between artists at the time? How did you hear about other artists? Whom? You've covered this. I mean, I think we don't have to answer the same question again. What were the things?
It was a large group of people who were basically friends and who knew each other through a few key organisations and events. We didn't have mobile phones then, so
or computers.
I remember early days of LVA having an hour-long phone call with David Hall from a phone box across the road from where I lived, and. He had to reverse charge the call so that we could discuss the formation of LVA, you know. So stuff like that happened.
Yeah, no, yeah. I certainly remember that too. You've got, what were the famous national or international places for the presentation or exhibition of video art? So, you know, that's important, I think. Well, famous, we can leave famous out, but national and international places that were presenting work that were kind of, I guess, key institutions during that period.
Yeah. Well, again, it was these organisations were contained people who knew people, and people like David Hall, Stuart Marshall, especially, were in contact with people. So we had LVA shows at the Air Gallery. The Tate Gallery did a couple of different video shows, probably connected up by David Curtis, actually. The Whitechapel Gallery, Whitechapel Open, I'd show video there. Serpentine Gallery from the video show.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about any others, to be honest. But
what about outside of London? What about outside of London, David? I'm just thinking.
Binning Farm.
And what about in Newcastle?
Well, they started the Basement Group in the late 70s, I guess. And I think they were in contact with the Newcastle City Galleries and so forth.
Coventry?
Again, Coventry, I think, was mainly the through the art college, but I did also screen in the Herbert Art Gallery in Coventry, their city gallery.
Yeah.
So there were little bits popping up here. The Arnolfini, actually. Arnolfini in Bristol.
Glasgow.
Yes. Mm. Glasgow and Edinburgh Festival. What was the Glasgow Gallery I screened in? The name escapes me, I'm sorry, but it's quite a well-known in Glasgow.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Okay, where are we? Blah, 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 blah. Distribution. Now we have to talk about distribution, aren't we? Yeah. Oh, hang on, wait a minute. There's a question of conservation and collection. Was the question of conservation and collection of works raised? By whom? And what actions were taken in that direction? Well, I guess that's an LVA one, isn't it? Really, nobody else did.
It is. LVA had a kind of strap line to its title. And I don't know whether it's in the catalogue here, but I can remember it. I think it was so it said, London Video Arts, the organisation for the production, exhibition and distribution of artists' work in video. Mm. So that was like a mission statement from the early days. And this catalogue from 1978, which I took that photo, by the way,
of the screen.
But sort of laying on the floor looking up at the screen. And I didn't think it was much good, but David Hall said, oh, well, it looks like a flying banana, so we'll use it. But the first thing, again, very much instigated by David Hall, was to just contact people as widely as we possibly could around the world and, you know, North America, people in Europe and all around Britain. And just let them know that this organisation was there to distribute work and basically collect, not gratuitously, but, you know, if they were prepared to lodge a copy of their work in the distribution, then we would distribute it. That was by 1978, that was produced with Arts Council money. And we had one machine to view things on. So you know, it started bit by bit with the distribution, the catalogue, then screenings, and then quite a bit later, it took till 1982, I think, to buy serious production equipment. Bit by bit, it did all get put together over... six or seven years.
So that, yes, I suppose that's the most important preliminary attempt to try and pull together and have a collection of works and make them available. And it wasn't until much later that you get the Rewind project, but now we're talking, what was that, 90s? So even beyond that.
Yeah, 2004, 2005,
Like that. So I guess until then there wasn't anything going on with archival, and then we have a whole section on distribution, which is the same answer, really, isn't it? Was your work distributed, and if so, by whom and on what basis? Was the issue of distribution important to you when you first started working with video?
I would say not to me personally, but again, it became a thing that was a, you know, involving a lot of people, and very much through the distribution tended to be to art colleges, and then fairly soon after became distribution to exhibitions and screenings, and then internationally.
Yes. Do you remember there was video artists on tour, the Arts Council thing?
Yes.
Which was that useful.
That got people to travel around to all the colleges and local galleries, and they got paid for it, and the work was hired, to distribute. But also there were other organisations starting up in. In Holland, in the States, in Norway, Germany. I think, in France, you know, it became a thing that countries would have their distribution outlets,
And I think what's going to happen is that individual people are going to respond to, you know, their own national relationship to the medium. And the idea is for us to sort of focus on what was happening in the UK, so then parallels can be drawn. I think that's the notion. I've got the storm now that you had earlier on. It's pouring down and there was some thunder. So, there's this thing with links with art school, which is really important, isn't it? When did art school start training artists in video practice in your country? Well, yeah. You said that, beginning of the 70s, early 70s. Yeah. And who led these courses and how were they imagined? Well, go on, you answer that. We I guess it's David and Tony
Stewart.
And Stuart, yeah.
And then other courses like at Brighton and Nottingham and... I'm trying to think where people were keen. You know, there were a few art schools that sort of led the way, as it were, into media. And now, of course, it's the bottom line for most places. You know, I was thinking that the other day. I had to go to hospital and nothing important, but
that's what they all said.
Sorry?
That's what they all say.
Yeah. Well, I won't digress on that one.
Okay.
We'll be here all day. But it was in Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, and they now have wonderful artwork, very high level of artwork around the place. And they've got a piece by Isaac Julian, which is five very big screens playing beautiful images of shot in the Arctic, I think, or Antarctic, but just very beautiful slow motion, water moving, ice, you know, very contemplative. And again, to just think both of Isaac and his development and through St. Martin's College, and it was where I first met him, and then moving into video, and then the type of video he makes now, and then the people who exhibit it and buy it, and the whole thing's come full circle. You know, that everybody would consider that to be a normal piece of art these days. You know, beautiful as it is, but it's just become the way to do that kind of thing. You know. Am I making sense here?
Yeah, no, you are making sense, because it's to do with this art schools and the way they started training artists, who led these courses. You know, as you say, it's evolved into a big deal. At the beginning there, as you say, there were a handful of art schools that had particular individuals who had championed the medium. And you mentioned the key ones, Stuart, Stuart Marshall, David Hall. They were the two first ones that that I remember going to Maidstone as a student when I was at the LCP and seeing what David was doing. That was my first contact with David. It was on some trip because Tony Sinden taught at the LCP. So Tony took us because Tony used to run these screenings after classes that I went to. And David Cunningham would sit at the back and make remarks, and I thought, who the hell is this guy? He knows everything. But yeah, there were, as you say, there were a few art schools dotted around the country. It wasn't just London. Yeah. I mean, I guess the Chelsea and the Royal College were, because they had kit, but they didn't really, there wasn't really a sort of video focus the way there was, say, at Maidstone or Newcastle, for example.
No, yeah. That's true. That's true. And you are reminding me, there were people at places like St. Martin's and Central St. Martin's, as it became. Tina Keane, I'm thinking of, and others, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah, well, because they're saying, did you participate in the transnational events and exhibitions? Again, you've talked about that. If so, which ones? Name and date, with which artist, and who organised the event. Do you want to say more about that, or do you think you've...
Well, I mean, that's like, I would have to kind of read out my CV to make sense of it.
Yeah, okay, I mean, maybe if you felt like it, you could photograph those notes and send them to me, and I could kind of give you know, the notes you put against some of these questions, so I could flesh it out for them a bit, if you like, if it's useful.
Again, whatever's the easiest way to do it, Chris. I mean, if if me, you know, I can just list a few quickly now. If I
fire away,
just get that.
Go on, and this is going to run out again. It tells me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So.
It'll just disappear. Don't worry. I'll call you up again.
Okay. So here I've got it. So this is about international stuff, really.
Yeah. This is transnational events and exhibitions. Name, right. Date, which artists and who organised it.
So, video and film manifestation at the Bonifanten Museum in Maastricht, 1976. I can't give you names.
Don't worry.
But the people from here who went were David Hall, Stuart Marshall, Pete Livingstone, Roger Barnard, Tamara Kukurian, Marceline Maury, we met there, myself, and, that was the English, British contingent.
Mm.
Then it was a little while, 1978, Montpellier Abstract Film Festival. Mm. I had a piece in that, can't remember what. And also at the Berchtesgaden Cultural Centre in Brussels, some work in there. I didn't go. Then Video Roma in Italy, 1979.
Mm.
I didn't go. Then I did go to, but we sent work. This is why the distribution was obviously working. European Video at the Künstlerhaus, Stuttgart, Germany, which I mentioned earlier with the Nan Hoover story.
When was that? When was that? The one
that was
79.
Yeah, and also 79. British Video, The Kitchen, New York, which had a catalogue with it as well.
Mm.
Then British 1980, British Video in the Theater Studio Warsaw. And also another Warsaw gallery called Dziekanka, Dziekanka. Then Gallery Cavallino Venice was a distribution job. The Apple Gallery Amsterdam, I took British Video there. A place called ILAC, I-L-A-C, Lyon, France. 1981. I'm missing out places like Tate Gallery, London Musicians Collective. Okay, I went on a trip around the States. Pink Noise Studios in Oakland, California, screening. That was the studio of Fast Forward and other people who all had made up names. Dr. S.O. Terrick, Penny Lane, et cetera, et cetera. Prime Video, Montreal, and or Gallery Seattle. That was with Alan Landy and Laurie Larson. Prime Video, Montreal was with, it'll come back to me, SpaceX Gallery, Exeter. And also I'm remembering here, I missed one out, which was in, still in 1981 on this trip, was Toronto College of Art.
Okay.
With,
yeah. That'd be Ontario College of Art. Yeah, not Ontario College of Art. OCAD. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and Toronto. Yeah.
Yeah. So we go, and then really, I think I kind of wind down from there on. I there are more, but I wound. You know, that was 82, and I pretty much
you'd had enough.
My team. Yeah.
Well, look, we'll probably run out and I'll call you again, but
yeah.
who are the artists or actors in the video scene you think should be contacted for this research project? Don't worry about that unless you think there are some...
You know everybody.
Don't know if I know everybody, but I mean, some people have just not bothered to get back, you know, get back. I mean, so, you know, there is what there is. Do you have archives of your work yourself?
Copies of work.
Yeah,
I've got a set of the tapes that the Rewind Project made.
Yeah.
So I have those on Digibeta and also as files on the computer.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. And Have your works been preserved, restored, or collected? Well, we know the Rewind Project has done that. And do you want to say, other than that one, for example, other than Rewind, have they been, to your knowledge, your work, say?
Well, this Lux has, you know, still there in distribution, and they're doing this BFI collection of I don't know much about it, to be honest, except that, you know,
well, they basically that's going on. So yeah, so I think that's important. So there's the Rewind, the Lux, and the BFI. Yes. I think those are probably the right ones.
Yeah.
And Zoom. There we go. Haha. All right. Say something.
Hello, hello, hello.
Okay, so it's picking you up. Right. So archives we're talking about, which you've done.
Right.
And it says here which works and in which places. I mean, I suppose, is it a complete body of work? Is it everything you made or only selected or what?
It's anything that I still had, basically. I got rid of a lot of work at a certain point in time, stupidly, probably, in hindsight. But most of what I made is preserved. Things like the tape for the Serpentine video show don't exist, but I remade that piece with a couple of people just because you could remake it tomorrow. You just give the same instructions, you know, but the equipment changes, but the piece is essentially still the same. So I've pretty much got most things.
Okay.
Just about everything. I've not got a lot of old original, you know, experiments and stuff like that. But the finished pieces on the whole I have got, yeah.
What about installation type pieces? Is there multi-screen things?
Well, now, I think there's a question somewhere that talks about the development of your work. I mean, what happened to me is, you know, I had a time out from video art making, and then I ran a production company for a while, for a few years, making sort of documentaries, really. And then I went into teaching, and then bit by bit, I started to collaborate with Susie Freeman and Liz Lee to make the Pharmacopoeia work. And by that time, I would use video as just a way of creating things. You know, the first piece I made with them is a big collection of 50-odd A3 photographs with framed, small framed coils, contraceptive coils, arranged on top of it, and the images are fuzzy, colourful pictures of mainly people, which I shot on video and then re-photographed from the screen in order to get that kind of fuzzy, brightly coloured video kind of look to it. So again, I just would use video as a tool in amongst, you know, for other reasons, if you like.
Do you think that your knowledge of the medium that you gained through working with it exclusively as an artist then fed into the way you were able to use it as part of a wider practice?
Yeah, I think, I think it's just familiarity, really. And time also. So we're talking about the year 2000 and on for another 10 years. In fact, we're still doing things that have come out of that. So, you know, I made another piece called The Pit, which is about a guy who's depressed, but I shot video of him. Of this guy talking, and then that's included in a screen sitting on a psychiatrist's couch. okay. So again, you know, it's a kind of loose way of using video just as an element within a piece of work that's about something else, you know.
But that's often the way it's used now anyway, isn't it? If you were to look, I mean, I think that the video art as a I don't know, kind of a genre or a it's gone. It doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I agree with that. No, it's just another tool now. You know, photography, film. Yeah. Well, film, nobody uses film.
No, that's true. Well, except Bill. okay. Right. Yeah. Well, okay, there's two things. One is, what are the essential books for understanding video art in your opinion? Interesting question. You may as well, since they're asking the question. And then I'd like to go back to the first one because I didn't record it. I missed it. So,
all right.
Just that first question again, you know, like really early days. Get you to see. Yeah.
Do you want to do books?
Yeah, just tell me what you think because they've asked the question and I think they will coordinate this. I think they'll actually look at it in relation to other countries.
Okay. So I'm going to go through these, not in any particular order.
No, okay.
Jackie Hatfield, experimental film and video articles, mainly by artists, including yourself. They're very good, actually. The analog book by yourself, very good piece. I'm going to leave that till a bit later. Catherine Elwes Video Loop.
Right, which was essays, yes. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, and then also Video Art, A Guided Tour by Catherine Elwes. I'm slightly editing as I go here. Rewind.
That's,
The Rewind catalogue, very comprehensive as well. Then
you got the old edition. You got the old edition.
Yeah, well, I guess so.
Video no, there's a bigger one. There's a bigger one.
Oh, right. then.
Oh yes. Yeah.
Signed copy even.
Oh, signed copy.
Video and film. There's stuff in there. Diverse Practices by Julia Knight, which again is an interesting sort of academic book, I guess. Then there's sort of vaguely related things. Right. Butler's Wharf. This is a general book around Butler's Wharf. And one just called Artist Film, David Curtis, and my name gets mentioned once in the same sentence with Marina Abramovich, which I'm very happy about.
That's fine, isn't it? Yeah.
But that's it.
Yeah.
Related to it. And then there's this.
Oh, I don't know that. What's that one?
Thing printed project.
So video in there.
Well, it varies enormously, but it's got the pharmacopoeia stuff in it.
Okay,
And then, hang on. It does have a piece that I made for it that is like stills.
Oh.
Stills from video, but it's making another piece out of it. Printed project. And then a couple of videos.
Mm.
There's the Rewinds anthology, as it were, as a video art pieces. And worth it to see the whole scene at the time is William Raven's 72-82 about the Acme Gallery and what they did. And this is just a wider context, really. And it also includes bits of my work in it as well.
All right.